Yeah, we don't have anything to talk about, except for the lecture. All right, there's a lot of stuff going on. We are in around 188-ish. In 198, the Seleucids. I don't have my awesome map because I forgot my iPad. But we have the Seleucids. They take over the area of our concern. They take over Judea, okay? From the Ptolemies. 188, though, Rome defeats the Seleucids and then gives them the Peace of Apamea, which has several components. What are the components of the Peace of Apamea? Yes, western territories. All territories west of the Taurus Mountains are no longer belonging to the Seleucids. What else? War elephants must be discharged, which that'll come into play in about 25 years. That'll come into play again. What else? Yes, the navy becomes something that they want them to surrender the majority of, if not the rest of it. Others? Yes, the major part of the Peace of Apamea that's important for our narrative is the tax. The 12 years, 15,000 talents, a ton of money. One of the other things that happens is the youngest son of the king of the Seleucids is sent to Rome until the tax is paid in full. That'll come in later because the youngest son is actually going to be Antiochus, but we'll get there in a bit. What we started with yesterday was there's something else that's happening parallel. Once this big tax comes into play, you have the Seleucids really working hard to pay back the money. But all of it goes on to their people because their richest area, Asia Minor, has now been taken away from them. So the people are burdened with a heavy tax, raiding of temples we experience because those are treasuries. So that's happening. At the time, though, we have two families inside of Jerusalem, the Oneids and the Tobiads. They really are going to dominate our narrative for the rest of today and into tomorrow. Oneids, conservative or not conservative? Conservative. Conservative. So that leaves the Tobiads as the non-conservative. I'd rather say non-conservative than liberal because liberal's taken on a whole new meaning with that word. So conservative meaning they're going to be working to preserve the traditions. Also, their conservative stance means they are not pro-Hellenistic. They are not pro-Hellenization. They're wanting to keep Jerusalem pure. Pure to the laws, pure to the lineages, pure to what God asked his people to be. The Tobiads, though, are pro-Hellenization. As a matter of fact, the Tobiads are also tax-collecting family. They are tax collectors that viciously acquire their taxes through at times murdering of people, at times that they'll even lead the Seleucids on a raid of the temples. So, again, for New Testament purposes, knowing this is only 150 years before Jesus tells you a little bit something about what people think of tax collectors. Yes, you can look at it in the New Testament, and it does kind of have this like, well, you know, they're taking money, and if they're going to charge money or make money, they have to charge more than what Rome is asking for, and so people don't like them. Yeah, that's true. But this takes it to a whole new level. It's because the Tobiad family, the non-conservative family, is a key part of the narrative that ends up ushering in one of the most difficult times in Jerusalem, where we're going to see here in about 20 years the abomination of desolation that is precipitated by actions of the Tobiad family in war against the Oneids. Okay? The Oneid family, who is their lineage? Zadok, right, exactly. The Zadokite lineage, which is, in order to be the high priest, you have to be able to say, this is where I come from, okay? So you have Zadok. Right now you have Simon the Second. Now it's important to keep the second there because in a minute we're going to have another Simon, but he's not going to be a part of the Oneids, so that's one of the reasons why I'm writing this on the board. Okay? Whenever you start getting all these names, it can get confusing until you can keep it in front of you, okay? So Simon the Second is the high priest, considered very, very, or remembered very reverently. As a matter of fact, you guys read in Ecclesiasticus 50 or Sirach 50 verses 1 through 8 and 11 through 13 and verse 20. But it talked about Simon the Second in glowing terms, deeply revered by the people. He is reigning, though, and he is fighting against Hellenization, leading that charge. The Tobiads, really kind of a progenitor of theirs, is a guy by the name of Joseph. We won't see him much, but at least it gives you an idea of parallels. Joseph, chief tax collector for the Ptolemaic Empire. However, he's going to be always looking to jockey his position for whatever it is that can help him. Now that the Seleucids, or the Seleucids, depending upon how you want to do with that, they have this big tax to Rome, and so the Tobiads are going to use it as their advantage to wage war against the Oneides. Okay? Making sense? Stage set. We ready for the next date? 187. In 187, in order to spite the then high priest, these are the progenitors, but they're not going to play a big role, because at the time, now, we are Onias the Third is the high priest in 187. In order to spite Onias the Third, who is the son of Simon the Second, a member of the Tobiad family, known as Simon. See how that's wonderfully confusing? He tells the Seleucid official, hey, if you really want some money, there's a ton of cash in Jerusalem in the temple. That's what he tells him. This guy goes to the Seleucid official, off the screen here, goes to the Seleucid official, and he says, you really need some money? Go to Jerusalem inside the temple. That's where you can get some tons of cash. Now, he's doing that in order to cause problems for Onias because he knows what will happen. If the official comes to take the money, Onias is going to be at odds with the Seleucid Empire, which is going to cause them to treat him and his family negatively and maybe even to exalt the ones that are even tax collectors for the Seleucids in the city of Jerusalem. You see what he's doing? He's like, hey, there's tons of money up there. You should go check it out. So Seleucus the Fourth, who is reigning over the Seleucids at this point, he sends, and I'm writing this guy's name on the board for a reason, he sends Heliodorus. I'm going to run out of, nope, got it. He sends Heliodorus to Jerusalem to confiscate the wealth in the Jerusalem temple. Okay? So the king, Seleucid, okay, is it 22nd yet? Do you guys know about the networking lunch? Can I take that down? Is that okay? Okay, just making sure you're all right with that. Seleucus the Fourth, he sends Heliodorus down to Jerusalem to see if he can get some wealth out of the temple. Onias the Third, the moment that Heliodorus shows up on the scene, he starts telling him, like, I'm telling you, this is a bad idea, don't do it. He's like, please don't do it. In 2 Maccabees 3, verses 4 and following, which you guys read, says that Heliodorus makes it out of the Jerusalem temple barely alive because a heavenly apparition attacks him, is what it says in 2 Maccabees. So Heliodorus does go into the temple, tries to take money, but a heavenly apparition or some sort of heavenly being attacks him, and he barely makes it out alive. But this is the beginning of the tension that's going to be raging against these two. Okay? Two families, not the two people necessarily. Although, Simon the Tobiad continues to cause problems to Onias the Third, to the point where in 175, so that's the next major date, 175, Simon the Tobiad has been causing so many problems for Onias the Third. Finally, Onias the Third says, I've had enough. And he goes to the Seleucid capital of Antioch. Now just to let you know, okay, first of all, you have the name Antiochus Epiphanes. His name is Antioch, the city of Syrian Antioch, where the Gentile mission will be launched from in the book of Acts, is the Antioch we're talking about here. Okay? Oh, man, I wish I had our map. If I have the Jordan River, you have Jerusalem down here. Antioch, if this is the Mediterranean, Antioch's like up here. So he finally, Onias the Third says, I've had enough. He goes up to the capital of the Seleucid Empire at the time, and that is to Antioch to defend himself.
So Ananias the Third, having tons of problems by Simon the Tobiad, in 175, decides to go up to Antioch to defend himself face to face. He's tired of sending messengers or ambassadors on his behalf, so he goes up there himself. Now that's important for what's about ready to happen. Okay? We good? Follow me so far? When it comes to history, sometimes you just have to do what we're doing today. Okay? You just have to really slog through the details. I promise it pays off. So fight the temptation of drifting. You're gonna wanna know, because this will climax it in a very big way here in about 8 years. Okay? Not of class time, but you could feel that way. Yes?
Is Seleucus in Antioch?
Yes. Or thereabout. I mean, as the king, that's his home, his headquarters, but he could be out on different expositions or expeditions for different purposes. Mm-hmm. He's a tax collector. Simon the Tobiad. Yeah, I mean, it's just a way of referencing, you know, like Jesus of Nazareth. You know, he is not like Jesus of Nazareth, just the name order. Okay, everybody's okay on that one. Making sure, you never know, your words can get twisted all kinds of ways. Okay, while Onias the Third is in Antioch, Heliodorus assassinates Seleucus the Fourth. Yeah, out of nowhere. Heliodorus wants the throne, and Heliodorus attacks and assassinates Seleucus the Fourth, killing him, which puts Onias in a pretty precarious situation. You don't want to really be in the city whenever the king is assassinated, because what happens is mass chaos. People are fighting for the throne. I'm not going to get into all that happens. Basically, he is assassinated. Heliodorus doesn't get the throne. Instead, who arrives but a guy by the name of Antiochus, which he will eventually call himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Oh, sorry, I guess it's probably important to say he is the fourth. Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus the Fourth, this is 175. We're still in 175. Antiochus the Fourth takes the Seleucid throne. And there's several things you need to know about this guy, okay? Number one, he does add to his name, not just Antiochus, but he adds it Antiochus Epiphanes. So Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. That's not right. Epiphanes. Yeah. Not an M. We'll get to that in a minute, Shane. Antiochus Epiphanes, which means God made manifest. That's convenient, yes? I mean, technically the long one is Theos Epiphanes, but he shortens it to Epiphanes to make his point. So you're going to call me Antiochus, God made manifest. That's how he envisions himself. Matter of fact, in 169, he encourages his subjects to worship him as Zeus, the manifestation of Zeus. So Antiochus Epiphanes, you do have people, though, and this is where I was getting it, who, you know, kind of as a joke, refer to him as Antiochus Epimenes, which means madman. Little play on words. It's a way of subverting the empire. Of slooping the Seleucids. Hey-o. Instead of Epiphanes, they call him Epimenes, which means madman. But what Antiochus does is he not only exerts worship of himself, but he increases the taxes in a very, very violent way. So the taxation goes off the charts. He also crams down the throats even more intensely, Hellenization. So, I mean, it's, in other words, it's the same trajectory we've been moving, but when Antiochus takes the throne, he takes it to a new level. Now, Antiochus comes in, and he has a couple of different issues he still has to deal with. Yes, the big 15,000 talents indemnity is probably at this point already taken care of, since it was a 12-year note. And at this point, we're at around 175-ish. But he still is under a tax of Rome. It's just not as intense. So he's wanting to keep on good terms with Rome.
He needs, in some sense, to deal with the perpetual taxing of Rome. But he also has the problem of he still is limited in his resources, because what did the Seleucid Empire lose? Asia Minor. So his goal is to expand southward, is to expand south into Egypt and take over what the Ptolemies have, which is, you know, the Egyptian Empire that does have some resources. Now, again, they are different types of resources in their quantity, and even in some sense just in their category than what we have in Asia Minor. But he goes into Egypt in order to compensate some of the riches that he lost in Asia Minor. Okay? So we're kind of on, now we know where the Seleucids are at, right? Because we're going to need to go back for a minute to the Ptobiads and the Oneids. Okay? We good? Any questions? Yeah?
Just one. Who was Seleucus the IV assassinated by?
Heliodorus.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yep. Helio's son. It's related. Yes, I know. Startling. Yeah, like a soap opera. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he is actually son of Seleucus the IV.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, that is a connection.
Are the Ptobiads Seleucids as well?
No, they're Jewish. They're just Hellenizers. They're just not Hellraisers, Hellenizers. It's different. They're just non-Greek supporters. They're Jewish Greek supporters, which is frightening for a Jew. Yes, Lydia.
What happened to Heliodorus after he assassinates Seleucus but didn't get the throne?
Yeah, he's killed. He's dead. And that was there's a lot of jockeying position for the throne, but I'm not going to get into all those details because it doesn't impact. But he's no longer in the picture. He just played a really important role, you know, coming into the temple, which sets a precedent for what will happen here in a minute. But then also making it barely out alive, but then killing him. His role is important, but he's done. He's off stage. He won't return. Okay? For our purposes, I guess I should say. All right. Onias III is still in Antioch when all of that goes down. 175. He's still in Antioch trying to defend himself against the accusations of the Ptobiads. So he's there whenever the assassination happens, when Antiochus Epiphanes comes to power. But then in 174, so he's still in Antioch in 174. In 174, he is undercut by Jason, who happens to be his brother. This guy is a punk, but he is an Oneid. Jason is an Oneid, but in 174, Jason comes to Antioch. He meets with Antiochus, and he promises Antiochus two big things. Jason promises Antiochus two things. Number one, he promises Antiochus that he will be a Hellenizing supporter, that he will Hellenize Jerusalem, which is pretty important for Antiochus because he's trying to elevate the push of Hellenization. And because remember the location of Jerusalem, if he's wanting to push southward, having Jerusalem securely in his back pocket is pretty important. So Jason comes along and he says, listen, I will Hellenize Jerusalem. And number two, what I will do for you is I will give you a huge payment from the treasury in the temple. Oh yeah, Jason's just throwing out all the stops. So as an Oneid who is of the lineage of Zadok, Jason backstabs his brother Onias by promising Hellenization, as well as a large payment from the royal treasury. And naturally, Antiochus is like, well, that sounds good. So he makes Jason high priest, deposing Onias. He's not dead yet. We'll get to that in a bit. But he deposes him and sends Jason back with all the power of the high priest. So Jason immediately gets to Jerusalem. First thing he does, we're still in around 174. First thing he does is he institutes a gymnasium in Jerusalem so that entertainment can start happening inside of the city walls. So you have athletic practices. For Jews, there's tons of stuff that happens here that's they wouldn't have been okay with. There's exercising, but you would exercise naked. And the problem is, because that's the way the Greeks, all of their sports were done naked. Even a lot of their statuary is naked, which is interesting because when the Romans come, Romans a lot of times, not only whenever they make statues, they have them more clothed, but even a lot of times Romans would clothe the Greek statues that were naked. Because Rome had, I guess, more modesty. I don't really know how that works, but they did. But exercising naked is a problem if you are trying to fit in with the other Greeks and you're circumcised. So what you have a lot of them is trying to cover up the fact they're circumcised or, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of this, or going through procedures to become uncircumcised. There is a major movement inside of the city of Jerusalem to reject all the things that make them unique, led by the high priest Jason. So he institutes a gymnasium. Hellenism begins to thrive in Jerusalem. You actually have priests rushing or even skipping some of their temple duties so that they can go and participate in the sports and the gymnasium. Hellenization has taken root because the high priest has opened up the floodgates, has opened up the doors. Okay? This ticks off the extremely conservative Jews. I mean, it ignites a fire in them that will explode in about 4 or 5 years. Okay, we good with his reform? Because I'm about ready to hit another date. Okay, we're about 4 years away from the big event. Okay, we're building. 171, next major date. Jason appoints Menelaus as the person that will take the tax or the tribute up to Antioch. Now, here's why that's important. Because look where I'm putting Menelaus' name. Jason appoints Menelaus, a Tobiad, to take the money up to Antioch to give the tribute that he promises Antiochus, this high payment he promises Antiochus. He appoints a Tobiad to take it up there for him. Jason at this point is about as backstabbing, about as to use an anachronistic metaphor, about as Judas as you can get. Menelaus, though, goes and takes this opportunity to outbid Jason before Antiochus. So Menelaus is appointed by Jason to take the tribute up to Antiochus. And Menelaus gets up there and he says, listen, I'll give you more. I'll give you more money, and I know that's what you need. I know you're struggling. I'll give you more. And Antiochus is like, okay. So now what he does is Menelaus becomes the new high priest appointed by Antiochus, and Jason is deposed. Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of like if you're bedfellows with the devil, don't be surprised whenever the devil sends you to hell. So Jason appoints Menelaus. Menelaus takes the tribute up to Antiochus, outbids Jason. Antiochus then appoints Menelaus as the new high priest, deposing Jason. However, this causes an even greater problem in Jerusalem. Because now, for the first time in quite some time, we have a non-Zadokite lineage and even a non-Levite. As a matter of fact, I think it's 2 Maccabees. Yeah, 2 Maccabees, wait a minute. Yeah, 3 tells us that Menelaus is a Benjaminite. He's not even a Levite. At least Levite would be closer. But as the high priest now, a non-Zadokite lineage, non-Levite as the high priest. Not even just the conservative Jews are going to have a problem with this. It's going to be broader. Even your moderate ones, they're going to be tolerant maybe of some of the Hellenization. But when you have a non-Zadokite, non-Levite, you start to see a groundswell of the Jews inside of Jerusalem that are ready to push back. So what does Menelaus do? He gets vicious. Matter of fact, his first goal is to exterminate all of the people that are a part of the Zadokite lineage, to exterminate the Onaiads. That's his first goal. Menelaus bribes someone. That's important in a moment. Menelaus bribes somebody named, you don't even really need to know his name. His name is Andronicus, but he bribes Andronicus to murder Onias in Antioch, because remember, Onias is still up there. This is 171, but he still can't get a good hearing. So he's been up there for quite some time now, and he is successful. So Andronicus kills Onias because Menelaus bribed someone. Then Menelaus also bribes someone to try to have Jason murdered, But he ends up escaping into Transjordan. He ends up escaping over here into the more of the desert region. Okay? So let me stop for a minute. Let me rerun out that. Menelaus bribes Andronicus to kill Onias. And why is he doing that? Because he's wanting to exterminate this line so that he has no one that can threaten his position of high priest. So Onias is in Antioch. He is now dead. He's gone. He also bribes somebody, Menelaus, to kill Jason. But Jason escapes and goes into the Transjordan. Okay? Now, I know some of these details may seem a little bit like, why are you saying all those details? It's because they all come into play here in just a bit. Like, every one of these, I've tried to synthesize this down to its bare skeleton so that we're only talking about things that will matter in a bit. Okay? Does that make sense? So I'm not just giving you tons of fluff, I promise. Which is also the reason why it feels like we're moving quick, because we are. So Menelaus, let's see, he bribes, yes. Oh, while Menelaus is on a different trip, so we're still in 171-ish, sure, 170. He's on a trip to Antioch. His brother, you don't need to know his name. Do you want to know his name? It doesn't really matter. Okay, I was going to say, sometimes too many names is not helpful. His brother is back in Jerusalem, and now that they have all the power, he's like, well, I'm going to do whatever I want. So his brother decides to just go into the temple and take some sacred vessels. He's just like, my brother's the high priest. I can do what I want. And as a Tobiad, that's just kind of the way in which you roll. So he walks in and takes some sacred vessels. It causes rioting, absolute rioting in Jerusalem. The people have just, at this point, they have had enough. Whenever you riot, you always get the attention of the empire. Now, Rome will be very vicious about this. You know, the Pax Romana will be something that's even advertised. But whenever you riot, even in a Seleucid empire that is working hard to get its feet back under it after Rome has done what they've done, over in the far east, you're having the Parthians really causing a lot of problems for the Seleucid empire. The Parthians are pushing into Babylon. So whenever they're trying to figure out just a way to get their feet under them, any sort of rioting in their region is a threat to their entire stability. Okay? So people start to riot, therefore someone is going to have to pay for this. And whose fault was it? The brother of Menelaus. However, Menelaus takes three members of the Sanhedrin up to Tyre, up to the city of Tyre, which is a little bit south. So you're not as far up as Antioch. But he takes them up to the city of Tyre, and he accuses them of being the ones that incite the riot. And whenever things weren't going that well, he ends up paying a bribe to the person so that he can be acquitted of all charges, and the three Sanhedrin members are executed instead. Now notice something. What does Menelaus do persistently? Bribe. That's why he has the nickname Menelaus Moneybags. That's how he was referred to. Menelaus Moneybags, always bribing to get something. Whether it is evil, whether it is positive, Menelaus just is Menelaus Moneybags. Always figuring out a way to use money to get out of a problem. Which sets a precedent. Actually, he's continuing a precedent, is he not? What Jason does to his brother Onias ends up backfiring because Menelaus takes it to an nth degree. And that will be a pattern. We'll see this. At this point, he is using money primarily as a weapon. Violence only comes every once in a while. But the small violence that he uses will be exaggerated whenever we move into the next phase. And it keeps happening that way. Somebody kind of does something. It's not that. It's not exaggerated. But then the next person exaggerates it hugely. Okay? Yeah, question or comment? It would have been depending upon like jurisdiction or the way the Seleucids would have demanded where the hearing was going to be. So Tyre was just the place that they said, we will hear you in Tyre for the accusations of rioting in Jerusalem. So, but he gets up there and does what he does because he's money bags. Okay? You guys need to just like stand and stretch for a second, or you doing okay? You all right? Yeah, go ahead. Who, Menelaus? In Tyre,
yes.
It was the group that was trying to convict him. So whether it be the judge or whether it be, you know, influencers that have something on the judge, he just bribes his way out of it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, we're going to leave them in a minute. Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah, it is. It did and it is. And what do I mean by that? Well, I mean, whenever you still look, whenever we're now firmly in the intertestamental period. Remember I told you guys a couple classes that what we're going over now, 1st and 2nd Maccabees is dominating. 1st and 2nd Maccabees is all, and the pseudepigrapha, and it's where we're getting a lot of this information. Well, from the Jewish perspective. So during this time, whenever you see heavenly apparitions, you're starting to see the emergence of other things that are even referenced in passing. It's not like whenever Heliodorus is attacked, it's not like they make this huge deal in the sense of like, oh man, and then this thing that comes out of nowhere and we didn't know what it was. It's almost like they say it in passing. This heavenly apparition comes and attacks him, which tells you that in the culture at the time that already something had developed. And I think it's because the reason why it had developed is because it had been revealed more robustly, or what had already been revealed. Because it's not like we only see angels in the intertestamental period. You see angels even throughout the Old Testament. It's just there wasn't an angelology really developed. So during this time period of wrestling with what already has and what is occurring, it starts to take root in a different way. But yes, it is developing significantly. I wouldn't say in the exile. I would say the exile was the impetus of the development, but it's really developing in the intertestamental period. Is that? And I know, I mean, I actually would argue the exile never ended. Like, I know there's some weirdness to even that statement, but for our sake, pre-exilic, exilic, post-exilic is helpful. Okay, we good? I'm feeling good. Let's do this. Okay, we ready? Okay. 171 to 170. We're kind of bridging a year or so. Antiochus is attacked by the Ptolemies. It's more down south. He's down south near Jerusalem, that region. But he's attacked by the Ptolemies, and the Ptolemies fail. They do not overthrow him. This is in 171 to 170. I'm describing kind of an entire something. As a result, Antiochus decides to march into Jerusalem and just take power over the whole land. He's just like, all right, enough's enough. It's time. So he feels like over the last couple of years, he's consolidated his power, collected more resources, and he's ready to launch his attack on Egypt. What is the result of his movement? His result was that he actually ends up taking power of almost all of Egypt. Almost all of Egypt.
Did you say that he marched into Jerusalem?
Did I say Jerusalem? I meant Egypt. I apologize. I'm so sorry. He marched into Egypt. He'll march into Jerusalem here in a bit. But no, he marched into Egypt. I'm sorry. The Ptolemies come up. They fail in trying to thwart him. He says enough's enough. He goes down into Egypt and decides, I'm taking over this land. And he pretty much succeeds, except for one city holds out, and it's Alexandria, which is ironic. Alexandria holds out. Matter of fact, they're able to hold Antiochus off until the summer of 169. He's not able, to overthrow them. Okay, so but 171 to 170, you have a launch of the Ptolemies against Antiochus. Antiochus decides that's enough. He goes down, pretty much takes over the whole region except for Alexandria. He cannot overthrow Alexandria. Okay. Summer of 169, he's still trying to lay siege to Alexandria, but they hold him off long enough where finally he's starting to run out of resources. So Antiochus needs money. So he decides he's going to go back to Antioch, regather, and then make one last push on Alexandria. But he stops in Jerusalem just to, you know, withdraw some money from the temple because, as rumor has it, there's a lot of money in there.
as we've already had people saying, hey, don't forget, you know, Simon's up here telling the Seleucids, hey, don't forget, there's money in the temple. Heliodorus tried to do it once, didn't go very well, okay? Antiochus this time decides, yeah, I need some money, so good old money bags. Menelaus says, hey, I won't even have you do this on your own. I will personally escort you into the holy place so that you can get as much money as you want. And he does, and he walks away. Antiochus walks away with around 1,800 talents, and which if you put into perspective, the 15,000 over 12 years, 1,800 is no small withdrawal. 1,800 talents worth of sacred vessels, worth of ornaments or decorations or temple cultic usages, 1,800 talents worth of sacred vessels Antiochus takes away. Which ticks off the Jewish people. I mean, Antiochus's goal may not have been to, quote-unquote, oppress or persecute the Jews, but that action from the Jewish perspective means he's now equivalent to, well, and I'm using this anachronistically based off of Alex's previous, he's equivalent to the devil now, even though the devil, devilology or Satanology is developing. It's not as robust as angelology, although by the first century it is. But Antiochus is equivalent to the chief enemy. He is the chief enemy now. You don't walk into the holy place and take away 1,800 talents and us not hate you profusely. Does that make sense? Yes. Menelaus. Menelaus. Yeah, Jason's still, you know, wandering around in the Transjordan because he's been deposed. Okay? That's about to change here in just a moment, but yes. Okay? Doing good. You're doing great. We have to do this. Sorry. It's just one of those days where you just have to slog through. So just stick with me, okay? 168. Antiochus makes a second expedition into Egypt. So 169, he wasn't able to completely accomplish his complete subjugation because of Alexandria. He goes back and regroups, becomes the chief enemy of all of Israel. And in 168, Antiochus makes a second expedition down to Egypt. Now, during this time, Antiochus still has his eye on the growing world superpower, Rome. He's trying to stay on good terms with Rome, and at this point he's been able to do it. Paying them some money here and there, not overstepping. Rome is caught right now in their third Macedonian War. Now, if you... wish we had my map. We're going to... No. Shoot. Okay. Mediterranean. It's going to be a small map. You have, you know, the boot. So Rome's up here. You know, Carthage is down there. You have Greece. You have Asia Minor. Okay. Greece, though, also is Macedonia. I know that's terrible. Macedonia. You have the Greek islands, but then it goes up into Macedonia, right? Then there's a small little channel that comes over into kind of Bithynia. Well, not exactly, but kind of. But then Asia Minor. You guys follow me so far? Then if you sweep down eventually, you get to the Jordan, Jerusalem, Antioch, Egypt, okay? So Antiochus is coming down to Egypt. Rome is struggling in its third Macedonian War. Now Rome is also cleansed to where Seleucids aren't in Asia Minor, and Rome is over here, but they're trying to squeeze out the center of the Greek Empire, the Macedonian War, okay? Matter of fact, the very first king that unifies, you know, the father of Alexander the Great was Philip the Macedon from Macedonia, okay? So they're trying to squeeze this out. That's where Rome is. That's important because what Antiochus cannot have is a conflict with Rome. He's struggling with the Parthians over here. He's now got this problem here. He needs to take over this, secure this, so that then he can have all of this to try to then push out one way or the other. But to get into a collision with Rome would mean basically the end of the Seleucids. Okay? So he is thankful that Rome is preoccupied up in Macedonia. So Antiochus goes into Alexandria hoping to wipe them out. The problem is, literally as he's on his way down here, Rome finishes the Macedonian War. They win. The moment they win,
they send a naval fleet straight south to Egypt because they know Antiochus is heading there. So they send this contingency down to Egypt, and whenever Antiochus comes into Alexandria, he is met by, I'm not going to say his name, he's met by a Roman commander. His name is Lannus. But the reason why it's important is because they were childhood friends. Remember, I told you that Antiochus was sent and was held in Rome until the tax had been paid. They're childhood friends. So Antiochus comes there and he sees his childhood friend, Lannus, and he's like, "Friend!" And Lannus walks up to him and he takes a sword and he draws a circle around Antiochus. And he basically says this, "Don't leave the circle until you've decided to surrender to Rome." And so he's looking and he realizes this, the worst thing could possibly happen has happened. Antiochus agrees to surrender, and then Lannus says, "Now let's shake hands." And they do. So it's this very intense, dramatic moment where Antiochus' submission, in a sense, means that Rome now owns half of the Mediterranean. Yeah, the Seleucids still have power over here. They still have power in Judea and up to Syria. They haven't completely lost all their power in Babylon. They're still fighting with the Parthians. But now Rome owns Asia Minor, which is rich in resources, and Egypt, which is rich in resources. You see the problem? So what mood do you think that Antiochus is in when he starts to go north? Yeah, he's not a happy guy. He's pretty ticked off. And Jason, remember our friend that's out in the Transjordan, makes a major mistake. He hears and buys into a rumor that Antiochus was killed by the Romans down in Egypt. So Jason gathers about 1,000 men, and they rush in from the Transjordan, and they seize Jerusalem, and they seize power. The problem was Antiochus was very much alive and ticked off and coming north. So basically Antiochus says that this movement by Jason was not an attack on a position, the high priest. It was an attack on his authority. And Antiochus was going to deal with it with that type of fervor. Antiochus' soldiers basically annihilate people in Jerusalem. Whether we're talking soldiers, citizens, it doesn't matter. You have tons taken into slavery, taken back into captivity because of Jason's mistake. And then Menelaus is forcibly reinstated as the high priest. So Jason takes a what he doesn't think is a risk. He thought Rome killed Antiochus down in Egypt. He decides to take back over. Antiochus isn't dead. Pretty ticked off because he says, "You've just compromised my authority." He then comes in, uses his soldiers, and they wipe out not just the soldiers of Jason, but they wipe out tons of citizens, taking some into slavery, deposing other ones. Now, Antiochus isn't done. He also needs to take future measures against future riots. He cannot have this keep happening. This problem stinking city has to get under control. So what does Antiochus do? Well, in 167, so we're in the next year, he does a couple of things. Number one, he sends a general down to Jerusalem with 22,000 soldiers or so on the Sabbath. That's going to be important. On the Sabbath, it's already come up once. And they're like, "Hey, we just want to make a sacrifice. That's all we're here for. We just want to make a sacrifice." They go in, instead of making a sacrifice, they annihilate people. And no one can fight back because they knew on the Sabbath, you're not to do any work. So Antiochus, this is the second time in Jewish history, but Antiochus uses the Sabbath as a weapon against the people of Jerusalem. And then, and this is the big one, we've been building for 47 minutes up to this moment. And then he decides to outlaw the Jewish religion. 167. Antiochus says, "The problem really is your religion. You guys have been fighting over the high priest. You're upset whenever I come into the temple to make a withdrawal. You guys are even, you have another deposed high priest coming to fight this high priest. Enough's enough. Jewish religion is outlawed. Therefore, he does, what is it, five things? He does five things. Number one, no more temple rituals. The temple rituals are done. They're stopped. And he'll replace them ultimately. But number one, he says, enough's enough. Stop temple rituals. Number two, destroy the sacred scriptures. Remember, we talked about this some yesterday. Sometimes what you need to do is to purify the literature so that you can, in some sense, control what it is they are digesting. So number one, stop temple rituals. Number two, destroy the sacred scriptures. Number three, the Sabbath and all festivals are outlawed. They are banned, no longer to be observed. Remember the things in the exile that kept the Jews separate. He's going to attack every one of them. Okay, so we have no more temple rituals, sacred scriptures destroyed, Sabbath and all festival days are outlawed, they are banned. Number four, dietary laws are abolished. You cannot control your diet anymore under Antiochus. So, let me read over those again so that you get them all. No more temple rituals, destroying sacred scriptures, Sabbath and other festival days are outlawed or banned, dietary laws are abolished. What do you think the last one will be? Based on what the Jews used to identify themselves in exile. Circumcision is banned. You're no longer allowed to circumcise your children. Why? He is erasing their identity. Erasing their identity. As a matter of fact, 1 Maccabees 1:50 says, and whoever would not do according to the commandment of the king, these five things, he said, the person shall be put to death. He's done. Tired of messing with it. This is the point we've been building towards, so get ready to write. This is the big one. On December 16th, 167, notice the specificity of that date. On December 16th, 167, we have what is referred to in 1 Maccabees 154 as the abomination of desolation. December 16th, 167, the abomination of desolation occurs, where a small altar is set up on the altar in the temple, and it was dedicated to Zeus, and pigs were killed on top of it, intentionally. So you have the altar, the burnt offering in the temple in Jerusalem that's dedicated to Yahweh. A smaller altar is put on top in dedication to Zeus, and pigs were sacrificed on the top of it. So the flesh and blood of pigs is dripping down the altar of Yahweh. The pigs was intentional because that was not even considered a kosher food to eat, more or less used as a sacrifice. And let's end with this quote from Josephus, Antiquities 12:253. He says, and when the king had built an idol altar upon God's altar, he slew pigs upon it, and so offered a sacrifice neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. He also compelled them to forsake the worship which they paid their own God and to adore those whom he took to be gods, and made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village and offer swine upon them every day. This is now reaching the climax of his push on them, and it will end in an explosion of revolt by the Jews that will dominate the next 150 years. Okay? We did a ton today. Well done. Get ready, because tomorrow is going to be fun. Love you guys. See you in the morning.